You spend time with your family?
Sure I do.
Good. Because a man who doesn't spend time with his family can never be a real man.
I know this is the right thing to do, Dad, because I would die for this kid, just so he wouldn't have to feel 1 ounce of sadness.
That's why you're here right now, to protect me, to be scared for me.
To be a good father. And that's exactly what I'm gonna be.
Hello, Dad? Yeah, I just wanted to say I love you.
Hi, Mom. Could you put down the phone for a sec?
This front kind to Papa.
Hey, Dad? You want to have a catch?
I'd like that.
Today, because I am so excited about our special guest today, Prim Saripapat, who is the greatest Duke alum I know, and also the greatest person I know, because she opted to marry Ben Aaronson, who, man, you've got to be the strongest person on this planet. So welcome to the Dad Pod, Prim. I know you've been on the show before and here and there, but today you are – the spotlight is on you today. You are bringing in the estrogen. You're bringing in the mom vibes, and you're actually going to tell us how bad we are as dads. So that's what we're doing today.
No, I have no intent of doing that. I am bringing estrogen. I am bringing progesterone. I am bringing – all the other hormones that Ben full well knows has completely taken over my body over the past 5 months. The first trimester was a roller coaster.
To be fair, those hormones tell me how bad a dad I am on a regular basis. So I think you can actually take a reprieve from that for this podcast.
What are you doing? Broccoli, where is the broccoli? I just tell you, just feed him vegetables. That's all I want.
A regular fight in our house.
No, I'd like you.
Well, this is going to be super fun. I'm excited. I'm excited to have you, Prim, and also excited to talk because this is a big week. On Monday, you announced on Instagram in an adorable set of photos. Your dog even has shoes on. What are those footy? I don't know what you call them. With the
paws, they're like the booty paws.
Was that arranged too? Because it seemed like it was all a big family affair there.
That's my OCD / Asianness coming out because, you know, we're taking photos in Manhattan and, you know, it gets real dirty out there. Plus pandemic and all that stuff. We were out on a basketball court. So anyways, but I forgot to say, it's so good to see you, Abby.
Oh, it's great to see you too. Thank you. Thank you. And you've already made fun of my, my microphone, my red mic color and my green arrangement here. I mean, that means that we're on another level. Because most people just don't say it, but you actually say it because we go back many, many years to the basement of the four building?
Four, yeah, but also in Miami. I mean, we've now known each other since I might have met you when I first started in Miami in 2007. So what is that? Almost 14 years. God, we're old.
What?
Oh no, my gosh.
So you knew Tom
No, it can't be 14 years. Is that 14 years?
Tom, we're old.
Oh, my God.
I don't know if you – I mean, have you – yeah, we're –
Well,
Tom
is so young. Tom's like 35, 36. What are you, Tom?
That's true. You are younger than me and us. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So. Surprising, I know with this hairline that I am younger than other people. But Monday, you made a huge announcement, guys, and I'm so happy for you. Life announcement, our family just got bigger. On August 1st, we'll have one fur baby plus two wild, crazy, loving boys. It's about to get real. Man, it's not just a great announcement, but great photos, adorable with the Nikes. Everyone's wearing the same ones. I'm not a sneakerhead, so I can't tell. Are those Air Force Ones? Like, what are those?
Yes. Yeah. Air Force Ones, and they're this special kind of worldwide edition. Duke went to a sneaker store and picked them out, and they just had this. It's all about like unity. And so it was like kind of a great little message. And he loves pink. We love black. It worked out perfect.
Yes.
Oh, that's awesome.
I love the pink. I liked the pink. So that's all I really had to say about that. And I wanted black because it's slimming. We always wear sweat. So it was a very easy uniform to put on.
Yeah, your sweats are looser than Ben's sweats, by the way. He's wearing tighter sweats.
Wait, his or mine?
No, Ben's are super tight.
Oh, yeah. This... He's all about the super tight, skinny sweats. I can't rock like that right now.
I'm not quite up to Waz and Trey's level of swag where it's now gone back to the baggy clothes. You know, like I'm trying to get there again. We'll see. It took me 10 years to get on skinny jeans. Now I'm moving off of it. It's just.
Welcome to fatherhood where you're just not cool no matter what. It's just, we're so behind. We're so behind. Well, first of all, Prim, how are you feeling? How are things going? I guess August 1st means in less than five months, so 4 months along?
Yeah, not 5 months along. I don't know. The months and the weeks are, I'm 20 weeks, so I'm definitely halfway there if I make it all the way to 40 weeks. I'm feeling pretty good. First trimester was a little tired. It was exhausting. It felt like the most tired I have ever felt, and that's including like my tennis stuff. It's such a weird fatigue. But then now that I'm in the second trimester, I'm back to like my old, you know, I kind of get up in the morning around 5 a.m. I work out, try to do some work before the kiddo gets up and all that stuff. So I'm kind of back to, you know, normal-ish stuff.
And this was very different from your first, from when we had Duke, right?
Yeah, because I was so ignorant that I completely missed the first trimester. Like I had no idea. I mean, I put on like 10 pounds and I just assumed that my jeans were getting tighter, but I was like, I had just come off the tennis, playing the tennis thing. And so I wasn't stepping on a scale. I wasn't doing that whole thing. So, I missed the whole first trimester. So,
and you weren't sick or you didn't feel nauseous or you just kind of chalked it up to just, oh, I'm done playing. So this is just regular life.
Yeah. And at the time I had just gotten off birth control. So I figured I was like, must be a hormone thing. Mm-hmm. I was also juggling my master's program and then working for Tennis Channel, flying across the country. So I was like, oh, you know what? It's been about 6 months since I was back in the office working. I must be tired because of that. Ben knows I always joke around with him because he's like, maybe it's because you're tired because you're working again, all this other stuff. I'm like, no, I'm telling you, like, it's like this different thing. And then I was pregnant and I went to go get my ultrasound and I thought it was going to be like this little pee, you know, that you see in the movies. And this thing had like arms, legs.
That thing, you mean Duke, your son?
It was like one step before Spaceballs when it comes out of your stomach, when it comes out of his stomach. Oh, it was like just like ready to come out. But you know, the funny thing was this time we actually found out, I want to say Prim was only 2 weeks pregnant, 3 weeks pregnant, and Prim just knew. And I was on a conference call, I believe, and she just held up the little thing. The stick, and I was like, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? Like it wasn't anger. I was just, I had no idea.
It wasn't anger. Why is that the first reaction?
Well, no, because I won't lie. My face just dropped because we had one conversation about her coming off birth control like a month ago. And she was 2-3 weeks off birth control. And so for her to walk in and be like, I'm pregnant, I was like, whose kid is it? Where did this come from? How did this happen so quick? It was just so quick.
By the way, the whole dynamic of like being, you know, because you and I have been in broadcasting for a long time. So the funny experience about being on a pod with your husband, you get to hear like the differences in your stories. So here's my story of what happened.
Yes.
I was like, no, what are you doing? So we had this conversation, like, should we have a second one? At first it was like, no way. No, hell no. And all of a sudden, like, my mommy senses start kicking in. I'm like, oh, they're so sweet and cute. So then finally we're like, all right, you know what? Let's do it. I was also having some issues with my birth control, having like a strong reaction to it. I was like, I need to get off this stuff. Like, it is not helping at me at all. So finally we're like, okay, get off of it. We'll just leave it to Mother Nature and the universe. Whatever happens, happens. Cause it's probably going to take a long time. I know spring chicken. I'm 40 years old right now. So I get off of it. And 2 weeks later, I'm looking in the mirror and I've been like in shape and like working out, you know how I am, Tom.
Yeah.
And I look in the mirror and I'm like, is that pooch? Like, what is that? I was like, what? I'm like, I've been eating clean. I just weighed myself the week before. I'm like in shape, Peloton, running 6 miles, like feeling really good. I just look, I'm like, damn, that's a pooch. And then my boobs are feeling all weird. Sorry to be, you know, blunt, but it's true. You guys know.
We're all parents. It's fine. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Like, nipple hold, all doing sorts of weird stuff. So I was like, so I went and got a pregnancy test, and of course the double line, I'm like, I can't be right. So I like tested again. It's like, man. And then I was so slammed with work, with schoolwork, because it was during finals week. And I was like, oh God, I need to work. I'm like, if I tell Ben now, then we're going to have to talk about it. I'm like, I'm so slammed with work right now. Yeah. I'm going to put it off. But the reason why I decided to tell him that day, we were about to go buy a car, and I was like, well, if we're going to have two, you know, maybe we need a bigger car. So I probably need to tell him, you know. So he had just gone to like try out this one car, this SUV, brought it back and was like, let me test drive it and all this stuff. And I was like, I should probably tell him, because if we're going to buy a car, it might change the car that we're going to get. So we run up. I was like, hey, you got a minute? Let's go. I just need to tell you something. You know, and so I was like, so he's like, oh my God, you're pregnant. I was like,
yeah. Ben, when the wife says, hey, we got to talk, what kind of thoughts are going through your mind?
Well, under 90% of circumstances, and to be fair, the car was a pretty tense thing. We even talked about it on the pod.
Yeah, we did. Yeah.
But under 90% of circumstances, I would have assumed that she was going to divorce me. And yet for some reason, I knew that wasn't coming here. So I still had a sense of, it's panic. You know what I mean? Like, you're like, oh my God, I'm not ready for this. Like, that's literally,
yeah.
30 seconds. I was just like, oh my God.
I have a picture of it, of him sitting on the, so I was like, so listen, I was like, I'm pregnant. I was like, I need to tell you, because you know, that might change the car, but I was trying to like move it along. Cause I was like, you got stuff to do. I've got work. Like, we'll hash it out, you know, later. But it was like, I want to be so mindful of, you know, I share my story about how quickly we got pregnant. I mean, it literally took a week later. But I think Ben and I have talked about this. I want to be so respectful and so mindful of all the couples that I recognize, like how hard it can be, you know.
So I don't
want to make light of that. You know, I just think that crazy circumstances and all that stuff. And you know, for us, it was just like, it was, of course, it's such a blessing, you know, but I think for us, we weren't prepared that it was going to happen that quickly. And so, you know, there's just that calamity of stuff that like, are you really prepared, and the financial burden of it, you know what I mean? And so, I don't want to make light of our situation getting pregnant so quickly. So,
it's great to hear all the different stories, because I feel like when we post on Instagram or on Twitter or on social media an announcement, and the basics are fairly the themes are similar, like your family's happy, everyone's smiling, but there's always a story behind it of like, there was tension, there was struggle, or there was a surprise here or there. And it isn't like, there's always backstories to those photos that might look similar, and the experiences are so wide ranging.
Yeah. And you know, I'm sure Ben has thought, or actually you guys haven't talked about it since we just made it public. I'm trying to find that picture of him sitting on the bed. I'll find it momentarily. But yeah, it was a range of emotions. And it continues to evolve, really. You know, I think Ben and I have shared experiences, but we also have very different reactions to this. Him as a father and having the expectation and pressure of like trying to be the so-called breadwinner and support the family, and myself like being the mother and filling in that role of like wanting to be there for him, but knowing I have a lot of like academic and professional responsibilities, and that's such a huge part of what I want to keep doing. So mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been a range.
You know what I think was really hard for us, Tom, was I, and we've discussed this a lot, kind of came from a background where everything was tense. And I think finances played a huge part of that. And while I make a good living, I'm not complaining about how much money I make. It's like you have a vision for all you want to give your kid, right? Like whether it's private school or coaching or travel, culture, book, like literally whatever it is. You know, I think we all have this this thing that we envision for how we want to give our kid. And I just think that like the second kid in that like literal moment, I was just like, we haven't bought a house yet. You know, I've been kind of like fighting for this promotion that I think I deserve. You know, Prim is applying for internships and she's going to be super busy. We got the pandemic. We don't know. All these things are going on. And I'm just like, oh my, like this just happened so quick. Like, how are we going to do it? And you look around at other families that have way less than we do, and they do it. And when I say fine, I don't mean that as a pejorative. I mean, like they do well, everybody's happy. And it kind of brings you back to earth to be like, you're gonna be able to give your kids a great life if you love them, if you can. But in the moment, I'm like, I'm not going to be able to live up to anything. You know, like I'm not going to be able to give them anything they want, anything they need that I had planned. And that was scary for like a good 2 minutes. Cause you know, the reason we do this pod, Tom, is we really want to be good dads. Like we genuinely care about being good dads. And I think that was hard, but the best part about this is, you know, Prim and I legit talk, you know, like every day, at night, during the day, maybe too much, but we really talk. So I can convey some of these thoughts and feelings, maybe not always right away, but you know, we can have these conversations.
Oh, that's great. What I'm seeing is Ben like just got a bomb dropped on him, just like oh my, head in his hand, just like he saw a ghost, just like what am I gonna do. That's the photo that Prim just showed here. Well, Prim, did you always think of yourself as a mother to be, like when you were a kid, were you like, I can't wait to be a mother?
No. Even up until, even after we were married, I didn't really see myself as a mother. I don't necessarily, and I think it's so important for myself to talk about that, because that's a thing that's not necessarily really out in the open with women. And whenever I'm talking to, you know, younger girls, I was like, I tell them, I was like, I didn't dream of getting married. I didn't dream of being saved by my prince, you know, riding on a white horse. And I didn't necessarily dream of being a mom or having a family. And I don't think that's a bad thing. It's just my innate disposition. It's the world that I grew up. But I, you know, it's not that I didn't have that. My parents, you know, have been married for many decades now. But for whatever reason, it's just not something that I envision for myself. But that doesn't mean that can't change. And it did change for me. And I was kind of like a late bloomer in that sense, where up until like 35, which is when Ben and I got married, you know, I was really focused on my career and I kind of like doing my own thing and I like being selfish. And, you know, I would say, like, long story short, it took a loss, if I'll put it that way, it took a loss to realize that I myself wanted kids. So, after my shoulder surgery, after I played the whole tennis thing, I got laid off from ESPN in 2017, played tennis, ended up having shoulder surgery, told my labrum, all this stuff. Got off birth control for about 3 weeks because it causes blood clots if you have surgery. Little did we know, somehow I got pregnant in that like 3 week period. Go back on it after my surgery, start having these like massive pains, go to urgent care Christmas Eve, calls us an hour later. He's like, hey, you're pregnant. You got to go to the ER because it might be ectopic. There might be some issue. And it's like, well, I'm pregnant.
Sorry, what?
But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Christmas Eve, urgent care, spend 8 hours in the ER. And it's like trying to figure, like, my God, we're pregnant and there's something wrong with it, all this stuff. We had to wait 72 hours because it was so early. It's what they call like a chemical pregnancy. And it was so early that they had to check on my hormones to see if it like doubled or tripled within that 72-hour period.
Right.
OBGYN calls, you're not pregnant. Turns out it was probably just a chemical pregnancy. Doesn't mean that you can't, but just didn't happen this time. Mm. So go home and I find myself sitting on the couch and I just start crying. And I'm like, why am I so upset over something that I never wanted? And experiencing that loss was so just, it was mind-boggling. It was shocking.
It flipped a switch that you didn't even know existed. You're like,
exactly.
Wait, there's something inside me that's mine and it's my baby potentially. And you didn't realize that like those levers could be pulled.
Exactly. It was that switch. And so the universe played the craziest, weirdest joke on us. And at that point, I finally realized, I was like, wow, I do want to be a mom. And I want us to be parents. I want to share that with Ben. And also our little fur baby. She was our first baby, our pity. So that's kind of like how it started for me.
Do you think that your upbringing or the way you were raised, did that influence your lack of maternal dreams? Or do you think that there was as much nature and nurture in that equation? Like, do you think that you were, your parents had any sort of influence on your kind of dreams of being a mother, not really being as strong as other women?
Yeah, Ben and I have talked about this, and I think it's become even more apparent over the past like 10 months since I started my PhD program, and it's something that I'm continuously exploring. Yes to all the above. I mean, I think being an athlete so young was a huge role, right? Because I think being an athlete at 7 and then playing for tennis for 8 hours a day, and then the culture that I was in, you know, in that sports specialization, like just focus on sports, don't focus on anything else. And then the upbringing of my parents and the Asian culture of like, you know, anything that's a distraction, like you just cut it out. You know, if you are going out with your friends at night, that's going to be a distraction. Focus on tennis and all this other stuff. So in my mind, like I had been conditioned to think about what am I doing with regards to like my success and my accomplishments and all that stuff. And I think I was, you know, inadvertently kind of trained to think of that. Now, on the other side of it, I think is really interesting. That's only come to the surface recently is that when, so I'm pregnant now at 40, and I always remember that my mom was 40 when she had me, which is late for that generation.
Yes. Yeah.
So when I turned 40 in January, I found myself so emotional because I had never felt closer to my mom, and yet I had never felt so different and distant. And it made me reflect on just like our roles as mothers and thinking about my mom in Mexico, Missouri, an immigrant and no family to help for daycare, no daycare, being the wife of a doctor, which is a very isolating experience. And also had, you know, she had gotten her PhD in educational psychology and like did nothing with it.
Wow.
And now the other side of it, if I'm going to be totally blunt, and Ben knows this, is that there is, I think, this underlying like bitterness. And I think I've noticed it with the past women, many women of the past generation, that they were told to be housewives and expected to be housewives and sacrifice everything else. And like, there was no option for career or job. And I think that underlying unconscious bitterness and resentment that I have seen that was unconsciously placed on my brother and I not in an intentional way, but you just hear of it, like made me a little very resistant to becoming a mother and being like locked down and being married and being shut off and suffocated and all and losing my freedom and losing my independence. And so it's just this thing where I've like, I have always, I told this to Ben about like me having to really work through those feelings and make sure that doesn't interfere with our relationship. But like those old feelings of like, I don't ever want to be my mom. And I like always say that it's not because I don't love her or respect her, but it's like, I don't want to be stuck, so-called stuck in this, you know, situation that you don't want to be in. And so career and making money and having my own identity has been so important to me because it's like, I don't ever want to have to like, quote unquote, suffer like maybe my mom or other women did. And she, if she were here now, she would say that she didn't really suffer. But that's because she can't necessarily, I don't know if she has the wherewithal to be honest with herself and be that emotionally expressive about that.
How did you come to that realization about your mother having this PhD and having this feeling pigeonholed to be a housewife or raising the kids and not pursuing her academic or her job or a vocation that she really wanted to pursue, but she felt like she had to be at home. When did you realize that? Was it when you turned 40 or was it conversations you had with your family? How did you get there?
Yeah. I think such an important part. So when I started going to therapy at 30 years old, I mean, it really started then. A lot of that is like untangling and finding out more about myself and finding out and learning about ourselves also means connecting ourselves with the past and our family. And through that, I began asking my parents tons of questions about why they did things the way they did. Why did they parent me the way they did? A lot of that was tied because of, you know, with our tennis experience, because it affected not only me, but also my parents too. And there's just a lot of just shit there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so, so I had had that repetition of like really finding out more about my parents and all this stuff. And then I think, you know, obviously like me being in psychology, we have to be trained to be so self-reflective and use ourselves as guinea pigs to, you know, find out more about ourselves and also recognize our triggers, our biases, mental processes and all that stuff. And so it's just been like a long process. And so I asked a lot of it recently, a lot of my, with my doctoral training, like asking my dad about work and gender norms and expectations for each other. Do you think you contributed to mom not getting a job? Did you ever tell her not to get a job? Do you recognize that she has had this bitterness for many, many years and yet she can't like really express it or will deny it or, you know, all this stuff. Like I just had this conversation with my dad maybe like 3 months ago. A lot of it has to do with my training and just like some of the things I'm learning in school. And it's very sticky, complicated thing, but it's just like really finding out information. It's like having my own research project and really like connecting the dots and also like being truthful with myself about how I've played a part in it, how I've internalized these experiences and really being able to like, you know, in our training, they tell us like, you kind of have to have two tracks as a psychologist or therapist. One is like really being engaged and being there with a client and whatever. And the other is like having a macro distant view where you're like paying attention to the overall patterns and everything that's going on. And I think that's just like how I kind of came to the recognition of that.
Were you attracted to Ben because of his fatherly potential at all? Or was it like,
it was his pets. Don't make me pull up his Tinder profile pic.
Oh, I've seen it. Is he on a boat or on a yacht or something like that?
Yeah. How have you seen it?
Because I think he uses it for iPhone avatar, some avatar, or maybe your Facebook profile. I don't know. He's extremely attractive, but I wonder because like when I got engaged with my wife, part of it was in my head knowing that this is going to be the mother of my children. Like this, she's going to be an amazing mom. Part of it. It wasn't like that was the reason why I decided to marry her, but there was a very big part of me in my head is envisioning that family, you know, 10 years down the line. And I'm curious, because you didn't grow up having this vision of you being this mother, always at the forefront, did you and Ben, when you guys got married, did you have that conversation about kids, or was it in the back of your mind, or was it kind of like, let's put this off until we get our sea legs as a married couple?
To put it very simply, I swiped right and I thought, those are the pecs that I want to be with for the rest of my life. I mean, if I'm being totally honest,
I didn't have much else going for me. It was just pecs at that point in my career.
Speaking of pecs, I was brushing my teeth and I looked in the mirror and I noticed my chest hair had grown. I have some gray chest hair coming in. I looked at my wife. I was like, Allison, are those gray chest hairs? And she goes, oh yeah. And I was like, are you more attracted to me right now? She's like, little George Clooney. I kind of feel like this is kind of hot. I was like, okay. All right, I'm here. All right. Finally, she's attracted to me again. It took me like 10 years after we got married. But yeah, I got gray chest hairs now, Prim.
I did.
Well, I'm more attracted to
gray hairs. Yeah, I've heard of gray hairs, like head, eyebrows, like here. But I've never really heard of the gray hairs on the chest being a thing. But then again, we've never been this is the oldest we've ever been in our lives. So
it's true. So Ben, how many gray chest hairs do you have is what I'm trying to flex on you on.
I have none, but I told some people at work the other day, I have like a reddish beard. And I was like, I can't wait for my beard to turn gray, because I feel like all the great kind of like creative strategy marketing leaders have like these graying beards. They have their kind of, they have their cool glasses. And right now, it's weird because the top of my hair is blonde or brown, but my beard grows like orange and it kills me. I fit in on St. Patty's Day though. That's for sure.
That's great. Well, I asked that about the pecs. I do want to know more about these pecs, but I also, I'm curious whether whether your view of Ben as a father, you're surprised by anything, because husband is different than dad and different than boyfriend, right? So what are some things that Ben has done or things that, you've noticed as him as a father, now that he's on the call, I mean, he's getting a little nervous over there. He's very interested to hear the answer here, but
it's almost as nervous as when Matthew Berry on our wedding stand asked me to read our Tinder conversations.
Oh,
that was a true part of our wedding ceremony. But yes, Prim, please tell them all the things that I do not do well. Make it public. Let them know.
Is the question like what does he do well or that has surprised me in his role as a father?
Yeah, because father is very different than husband, which is very different than boyfriend, right?
Yeah. I think like the thing, I was just thinking about that this morning, because I think the hardest thing for parents today is like balancing what we learned and maintaining tradition, but also creating a path for ourselves, because we do live in a completely different time and you want like that generational progress. So I think like what Ben does really well is that he can easily let all the other, let go of the old ways that certainly that he recognizes does not serve us or the family, but also kids and the future generations. And that could be deconstructing and completely omitting like the old hyper-masculine ways that I think are still very much present in today's society, especially being a father, the whole like, don't cry, like, you know, big boys don't cry thing like that, you know, and I think that's still something that we're battling with. But I think he's so heavily involved and he's so unafraid to just like step in and help. Whereas I think there's a lot of other men and fathers that think, you know, that their role should look like this, mm-hmm. or they should do this, or their wife should do this, all these shoulds. And those shoulds can really affect a relationship and also prohibit anybody from doing really impactful things. So
it's kind of like your mother should be a housewife or should be raising the kids yeah. when really she feels like maybe I should be doing something else and, right. and not be put in that box.
Yeah.
We're always thinking of that, of like either our own childhood experiences of what dad's like. I always remember, and maybe I'm remembering this poorly, but my dad always was my coach. And like mm-hmm. would come home, he would take the train in from the city and always be there for my like 7 o'clock basketball practice or baseball practice. Mm. And I think that has been passed down to me, where I want to be the coach, or I want to be there for my daughters if they want to pursue athletics. Like I feel like yeah. I want to be there, but I also feel like that's also, taking something that my father did and placing that expectation on myself as like, that should be the norm. Like you should do that. And so like things like that, where I'm taking what my father did, which was amazing. I do think there was a little bit not compensating for not being there. And he went on a lot of business trips where he'd be gone from for like weeks at a time. And I think it was his way of being involved, directly involved. And, I think as a father, you kind of look at that and you want to take pieces of it. And there's almost this, not a burden, but a responsibility to continue passing that on and continue doing that. But you also should be aware of like, that was 20 years ago. That was 30 years ago, right? And so things have changed. Gender norms have changed. Parental norms have changed. The society has changed. And so I think Ben and I mean, raising our kids as young as they are, I think we know what we want to do. We think we know how we're going to raise our kids. But like the whole sports thing hasn't happened yet.
Yeah.
And it's going to be interesting to see that dynamic, because for you as high of a tennis player of anyone I know in my life, high level tennis player, you got to imagine that. That dynamic is going to be intense too, is trying to, if Duke wanted to pursue a sport, how do you think your upbringing is going to influence how you're going to parent a child who wants to play soccer, but doesn't know if he wants to like be a pro soccer player?
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, so, you know, that's interesting about your father. And I think that's like, I think the best thing that a parent can do is like take those nostalgic moments, the moments that are very important to us, and of course transfer them over into our experience as parents, but recognize like the framing of it could be different. So you could still be the coach for your daughters, but what we envision as coach might only be restricted to athletics and them playing basketball. But to expand that view and be flexible and malleable, to recognize that we could be them coach in other ways, to coach them in, you know, how to be a great student and ballet dancer and artist, and to also be a really good person, and to coach them when they go to school, to middle school, and they get bullied for the first time ever, they experience their first breakup, like to coach them. Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
So I think it's just like really reframing that. But to answer your question about just like when Squirm gets into, whenever he gets into sports, or if he does, you know, it's the same thing. It's like really letting go of those expectations and or the hopes that we have for them. That's the hardest thing. Cause I mean, how many times do you see it today? And it's just getting worse. The parents living through their kids. That is not why you brought them into this world, to be a vehicle for you to live vicariously through them. It's for you to create opportunities for them so they can express themselves. Like that's the problem that I think the challenge that all of us parents have is to give kids the freedom to express themselves. And that's like, it's such an interesting thing, like bringing in like all the training I'm doing in career counseling and like all these other theoretical classes that I'm taking is, and in my career counseling course, we're talking about like the intersection of familial upbringing and context and environment and how that shapes the kids and their, and I think, you know, the most important thing, I'm kind of going off track here, but I think just the most important thing is like, Ben and I don't want to restrict Duke, you know, just because I was in tennis, like, that shouldn't be an expectation for him to get into it. You know, that would be unfair.
If he picked up a tennis racket and started batting a tennis ball around, what kind of emotions?
Oh, he's already.
What kind of emotions are you feeling when you see that? Like, are you like, yay? Or are you like,
yeah.
Oh man, I'm uncovering a lot of like personal experiences with tennis that it's as a mother, you're feeling one way, but personally you might feel a different way.
Yeah. Bill, were you going to say something? I don't want to cut you off.
I was just going to say, you know, there's two sides of this. Removing expectations does not mean that you have been disconnected from their interests, right? So if Duke never wanted to be a pro tennis player, shouldn't bother us, right? But the idea that he enjoys playing tennis and that is a point of connection with Prim is phenomenal.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And he's already started grabbing a tennis racket. And we spent an
very
hour and 10 minutes, on the court, him just wanting to run around over the weekend. And at 2.5, that's like a big deal. And he's rather coordinated with swinging things. There are other things like it's hard to get him to shoot a basketball. Like he just wants to dunk it. He doesn't understand the concept of like shooting it.
Yeah.
And he loses interest after 10 seconds. You know, but with tennis and hockey, anything where he's
swinging and hitting, baseball, swinging and hitting, loves it. Boom, yeah. Loves it.
Like 18 months old, he saw a ball and a tee, just grabbed the bat and knew to hit it.
Whacked
like
it.
Nobody taught him that. So those things are exciting. I think, you know, ironically, Prim and I started watching the Netflix documentary on the college scandal, like
Scheme,
like Aunt Becky. Yeah, no. Aunt Becky and all those like parents paying to get the kids in.
Aunt Becky.
Yeah. And so we were watching it last night, and what it immediately makes you realize is I spoke about in the beginning of this, you have expectations for what you want to give your kids. Right now, my expectations of wanting Duke to go to a good college are genuinely not because I need him to do it for me. I just want to make sure that I give him the best opportunities to get there, right? But then when you start watching this stuff and you see how it plays out and you see how addicted people get, Tom, I'm sure you've seen parents who spend tens of thousands of dollars getting their kids private coaches just to get their kid a college scholarship when it's like, you know, if you just save the money, like they could just go to school, right? Like you don't have to have all this pressure.
Well, how much was the Aunt Becky thing about their own social status or Aunt Becky's social status amongst her friends or her peers that my kid is going here? Or how much was the driving factor actually a selfish driving factor? Is about herself?
Prim, you can tell me from your perspective, but from my perspective, it seemed like overwhelming majority of it was about the parents' pressure for status combined with the 20 years or 18 years of social status pressure put on kids about their self-worth being tied up in what school they go to, right? And I think all of that combines for this thing, and it makes me, somebody who's very ambitious when it comes to education and career and all this stuff, go, man, like I would never do those things, but if I somehow even just behind the scenes created the type of pressure that would even create the reasons for those side doors to exist, like that's problematic. And last night while watching it, I just kept thinking like, I need to rethink how I think about education and make sure that I'm keeping the focus for Duke and baby number two on, I want them to be educated because education is important, not because the brand name is going to have some demonstrative impact on who you are as a person, right? I just want you to care about education because it is an important thing. I don't know, Prim, do you have a different take on that?
Yeah, I think it'd be unfair to make a sweeping generalization and say everybody there was operating off the same motivations. I think every single parent is different. And we heard, this documentary is really fascinating. I don't know if you have Netflix, right, Tom? Or maybe not. I don't know. Okay. But it's called Operation Varsity Blues. It's called Operation Varsity Blues. And the documentary is really fascinating because they recreated the entire thing off FBI wiretaps. And so you get a real, like, inside look into some of the conversations that were being had. And obviously, some of them were really just, like, genuinely worried about, you know, what is my kid going to think? And I think the thing that I took away from it is that I think when you get to a certain status, wealth, prestige, all this other stuff, there becomes this thing where you are so used to this level of success and achievement, and you have access to so much, and you want to give that same opportunity and those same resources to your kids. But I'll always remember I was watching an interview. I think it was with Abby Wambach and I think it was her partner. And she had said, as they became parents, because I think her partner has kids, and she had said, our job as parents is not to protect them from pain and getting hurt, but to prepare them for it. And we can't, like, preventing pain from our children, of course, that's what we want to do. But that is just like an inevitable aspect of life. And that's always stuck with me. And so I think that's like the thing that those parents really fail to do is realizing like failure is such a huge part of life, as we all know through sports. And that's like one of my favorite lessons.
You can't get pecs like that without tearing a little bit of muscle so that they can recover stronger.
Exactly.
You need to tear a little bit. You need to push to failure, and then you get these monster pecs.
Exactly. And you got to go through some hard moments. And Ben always, I don't think he was fat, but he always jokes around about how he was and all that stuff.
I will find for you guys my Jonah Hill photos from around 2000. I was 228 pounds.
Wow.
And to give you perspective, because Tom, I know you've shared your chubby moments here.
Tom's reaction—that's so funny.
I'm 100.
Doing that, I mean, Ben isn't 6'10", so 220 pounds is
And I weigh, just for perspective now, like when I'm fit, I weigh about 165. When I wrestled in college, I wrestled 157, and right now I walk around 174. So that's 50 pounds heavier than what I weigh right now.
Wrestling is insane. So I played basketball, and the wrestling team would always be doing the craziest shit.
Yeah.
Like conditioning wise. And we would be doing sprints on the basketball court, and you would see the wrestling team in the corner doing like a billion stairs up and down, full sweatshirts, full sweatpants, and then going running on the track. And it was like insane. Like wrestling, I feel like is like almost militaristic in how crazy it is and just discipline and cutthroat it is. Just wanted to say.
I mean, listen, I walked on because I woke up one day and I was sick of who I was as a person. I was overweight. I'd become lazy in school. I was depressed and demoralized emotionally. And so I needed to change. I had some friends who were wrestlers who were, and Lehigh, for those who don't know, is like a Duke level wrestling program, you know, Duke basketball. It's like top seven all time. And I just had friends who were wrestlers, and they decided to take an interest in helping me out. And Coach Strobel, who was our Olympic coach at the time, you know, was like, hey, next season, if you can make weight, make it through preseason, you can be on the team. So it gave me this goal. And I got everything in my life organized, because to drop 50 pounds and to be not just fit, but fit enough to make it through practice every day with these guys.
Yeah.
I had to really become a disciplined, diligent person with everything, with my school, with my eating, with, you know, my relationships, with my psyche, right? And that stuff all comes back to the things that I think matter in being a parent and what I want for Duke. You know, I want Duke to work hard, not because of the results, but because that's the way you should do things. I want him to enjoy things. You don't have to do the things I did. Pick the things you enjoy, but then work hard at it. right? And I want him to also realize, like, everybody's ceilings and expectations, everything's different and it's all fluid. You know, like, Tom, you and Prim have both been in TV and media and sports media. What your dream job was 5 years ago is different from what it is now, both in terms of pay, responsibility, all of that. But when you're 10, 12, 15, 16, you feel like everything comes down to this one thing. Oh my God, this girl doesn't like me. My life is over. Oh my God, I didn't make varsity. My life is over. I didn't get an A. My life is, everything is like, are these make or break moments. And, you know, you ask Prim what I try to be, you know, different as a parent. What I will say, whether I achieve this or not, I don't know. The one thing that I always say that matters most is that there is fun in the house, right? Whether we are playing a sport, whether we are cooking dinner, the energy is fun. I get excited to wake up every day to see him. Does that mean I don't get tired? No, of course not. It's tiring being a parent. Does that mean I don't get annoyed? Of course not. I get annoyed being a parent. But I do my best to try and fill the house with fun, even when you're working hard, right? It's fun. Because you know what? It's actually a privilege to even get the opportunity to work hard. You know, it's a privilege to get the opportunity to walk on to a collegiate wrestling team. That is a privilege. They didn't have to do that for me. And so, you know, to bring it back to Prim, I think the thing that we balance each other with is Prim is somebody who hard work, I don't want to say it came easy for her, but she's built to do it. She's amazing at working hard. Prim is also somebody who is far more talented than me in like literally almost anything. She will also be the first to admit she's had a lot of advantages too that have enabled her great skills and talent and hard work and effort. And what I try to bring to the table is, hey, like, this is how so many other people have it, because I had it tough and yet I didn't have it one tenth as tough as so many other people. But I also bring too much pressure because of that. And Prim takes me out of that. And Prim tries to balance me and bring me back to, like, hey, things aren't going to be awful if we don't do this. Like, things aren't going to be awful if we don't have the right house or the right whatever. You know, all of those things we balance each other with, right? And I think that's hopefully what makes us good parents.
It's a good checks and balances, right? Prim, did you feel like working hard was just something you were gifted in, or did you have to work hard to work hard? Yeah.
No, working hard. And it's a blessing and a curse. You know, I think from the outside, people may be like, oh, that's just something that she does, or she's such a hard worker. But the other side of it is that, coupled with my personality, it can also become really toxic. You know, I'm one of those people that will work hard to a fault, and I won't interject any leisure or play. I don't know how to turn off. And I'll get, and Ben knows this, like, I'm really hard on myself, and that can create some really dark moments. So yeah, it has always come easy to me, but there is the other side of it too.
Yeah, she does. I won't lie, like, even while being pregnant, right? Like, she was mad that she couldn't work out as hard as she's used to. She was mad at herself that she was tired. Like, and she's rationally aware of, hey, I'm pregnant. Like, yeah. It's not like she's blind to it, like pregnancy one in the first. But those, I think those things, and that's where we do try to balance each other. And we do have a good checks and balances. But what I will say is, like, when we do have tough moments, it's usually because we hold stuff in, because we're not talking about it, right? Because we're not eloquating what we're feeling and what we're going through. And it's really weird, but I don't know if you notice this with your kids. We feel like Duke and even Bella, our dog, really notices when there's tension in the house. Oh
my, it's so crazy. Daddy, why are you yelling at mommy? I'm like, I'm not yelling at mommy. And mommy's like, he's not yelling at me. And she's like, well, you were so almost going there. And I was like, Wow, you're picking up like she can pick up like verbal cues that I'm ready to get upset and I'm ready to like she they're sponges. They pick up so much, and it really is amazing. And like my dog, same thing. Is like when I'm really sad, but I'm not like crying, he'll just walk over to me and just sit right next to me, and I'll be like, you could tell. And Amin Al-Hassan will say, your dog doesn't, he just wants to be fed. Like, he's not picking up any of that shit, right?
Amin would say that.
Like, but it, as a dog person, I fully believe that they're able to pick up on that energy, whether I'm like releasing any sort of hormones or something where the dog is smelling it and he's like realizing, all right, I got to go over there and be a companion for him. But it is amazing what they pick up on. Last thing here, which might have been the first thing we should have talked about, but as someone who is a mother and bringing in another human being into the world, this might be a crazy time for bringing an Asian child into the world where you're trying to create a safe, nurturing environment, and realizing when you step out into the world, it might be different for your children. What has it been like to read the headlines, seeing what's happening around the country and around the world, and also reflect on your own experiences? What has that been like for you as a mother to see all this racism and violence towards Asian Americans in this country?
Yeah, it's been such a long, that has been a long process. It has not been a recent thing. I think that the first time that I remember this coming up is when we went to watch Crazy Rich Asians. And that was in 2018? So?
And we were in San Francisco.
Yeah. I was pregnant. And so Ben had the revelation that he's like, my God, I'm never going to be able to connect with our son because I am a white man and he will always be a mixed race, biracial, bicultural child. And so that is kind of like when all that really began. So I think the most important thing to point out about all this, and this is my experience, is pointing out that, yes, this is an Asian American experience. And of course, I am hurt for others, all of that. But I also have to recognize my privileged position, because while we always like to think about the differences between groups, there are much more differences within the group. So if we were just to take the Asian population and community, for example, my experience as an Asian American is so deeply different from an Asian who is an immigrant, or even my parents who came here 60 years ago versus somebody who came here 20 years ago. My parents who are, established, my dad who's a doctor versus somebody who might be come from a poorer background. My parents can speak English. I can't get any more American than this, And for somebody, so you listen to some of those 911 calls, and they can't even articulate the danger of their situation because there's that language barrier. So I think that's like the just unique thing that needs to be pointed out. Of course, we're all collectively as a community, like trying to combat this, but it's also realizing that everybody's experience is going to be so different. So let's just call it out, like aesthetics and like how somebody looks really kind of, I think, dictates their experience as well. How you carry yourself, how you look. So just take my situation, for example. I think what benefits me is that I kind of look ethnically ambiguous. And Ben and I talk about this all the time. When we went back to Thailand in 2015, and I had been back for maybe like 15, 20 years, and I was expecting to go back and be like, this is going to be weird. And then look around and feel like everyone's like my brother and sister. And we go back and I'm like, I look like nothing like the people here. And I'm like, it's just one of those weird things. It's like, because I grew up in America, like, does your look change because of your environment? And so even my parents have always said, like, you don't really look Thai. You don't really. And so when I was living in, when you and I were in Miami, people would always come up to me and be like, expect that I'm like Latina, and they would always speak Spanish. And so I think that, and so recently with all, with the racial and social justice movement and all of that stuff bubbling to the surface, I mean, just to show you a little bit of my experience, is like walking down Hoboken and somebody drops the N-word with me. So that's just like to give you a little context about like how I may appear to other people. And that's how it's going to shape my experience.
But the point is that you're an other. It's like, yeah, to a lot of people, it's, yeah, that's what the evil part of the component of this is. Like, you could be Asian, you could be Black, you could be any, as long as you are an other, you are my enemy. And that kind of deep seated hate is so disturbing, is that they don't, all they have to do is just look at you and say, other, not on my team. Like, we are in opposition. And that's what's so boiling upset about it, because it just, there's something wrong there, that when you walk by a white person down the street, that like that white person might look at you and see enemy rather than friend, citizen, coworker. Like, it, that's what bothers me, is that the randomness of all of this, is that the attacks that you're seeing are just, they don't know who these people are. It's not a workplace thing. It's just like walking down the street or like in a store. And it's just all the information those people are getting are just, they don't look like me. They look like this other, this enemy, this Asian enemy that we've been kind of told by the media, by the administration, that like they are the problem.
Yeah. And I think that part of the problem is, Asians suffer from this in a similar way to Jews, is the success of a small amount of us has made it seemingly okay to attack everyone, right? It's like, they're rich, they're successful, they stick together, they're the successful minority group, right? But they weaponize that against people. That's one piece of it in macro culture. Like, I don't know if you've seen all of these things that they're like, you know, limiting, and there's all these things going back and forth about how many Asians should be let into top universities. And there's weird things that go on in this otherization that you've spoken about. Simultaneously, women, Asian women specifically, are fetishized, right? Like, they're created into these, you know, real life memes of submission. And then you have Asian men, and you'll hear like Carrie Chow or Pablo Torre talk about this all the time, how they are emasculated constantly in TV and film, etc. And, you know, you see all this, and it is inextricably connected to the behavior of this, you know, racist and sexual predator, whatever you want to consider this guy who just killed these eight people in Georgia. It's all tied together, right? And it's the problem with how we view people as less than, as objects, as something other than people. And it's really challenging, you know? And when Prim started all this with talking about that crazy Asians thing, the reason I became so aware of not being able to connect with my son was, there was all this media banter, even by Asian media, about how the star of that movie wasn't Asian enough, right? They picked a half white Asian, so it wasn't good enough. And by the way, I'm not here to legislate whether that was right or wrong, because I also see it in the Black community, right? Like, they don't pick dark skinned people. And by the way, I get it. Like, they need to. They only pick light skinned people because they feel like it's less, you know, offensive to white audiences. Like, so I'm not trying to get into the weeds with that. I'm just saying those are difficult things, which unfortunately I'm only ever going to be able to sympathize with, not empathize with. I'm never going to know the right, actual right things to say. And I won't lie, you know, Prim going to class in New York City, walking around Hoboken, like these random attacks, like this is not just shootings. Like, there have been like 20 people punched or stabbed in New York City just standing. Just standing there, Asian people, Asian women. Like, it's, for the first time ever, it's actually scary. Like, I actually think about, like, Prim, my pregnant wife, who's Asian, standing on a sidewalk waiting across the street and getting stabbed.
Is it scary for you, Prim? Whereas Ben is being a paternal figure, being like, I'm scared for her and I'm worried on her behalf.
No, I think it's, you know, I don't know. I guess maybe he is scared for me or whatever. There's been primarily because of the political climate. And when President Trump was in his position, there was permission, right, to all let all of this out. And there's people were given the permission and freedom to be racist, to act on their racist attitudes. And when that was going on, I definitely noticed certain parts, like if we were traveling to New Jersey or whatever, I get glares. Stairs, longer stairs than I normally would. I think the mask makes it a little bit more difficult. I don't, you know, I'm not necessarily scared. I'm not scared for myself. I think I saw William Tong, who's the attorney general in Connecticut, and he was on CNN talking about, listen, like, just like him, we are in a position of privilege and we have a certain status where I think we are in some ways protected from that. And even if somebody calls me a name, it's really annoying. It's, I wanted to like bite them. But you know, that is not my place. I'm a mother. I have to. So I think if we're shifting the conversation of like, this is a problem, we all know it's a problem. So like, what can we do about it? So I think for me, it's less about steering away from my old role as a broadcaster and public figure. I've been like very kind of dark on social media. It's just not something that like, I'm really engaged in. I'm also not somebody that's like going to shout out my opinions. I just think that like, I feel like I shout out my opinions and the people that agree with me are going to agree with me. And I'm certainly not going to change anybody's mind. We all know that. If we go on Twitter, you know what I mean? Like, I'm not going to change on it.
Yeah.
Right. So I think for me, the biggest part is like creating an environment here and making sure that my now both of my boys recognize the issues that will come up because they are bicultural and biracial kids, but also making them feel comfortable to be who they are, regardless of their skin color, regardless of how their eyes look or whatever. And I think that's some of the things that like have come up, especially in my training and listening to other Asian Americans or other, offspring whose parents are immigrants. You never feel like you're Asian or Latin enough because you can't speak the language. You feel like you're too dark. You feel like your skin is too light. And those are things that like past generations will kind of bring to the surface. And those are things that have been told to me, like, you're not Asian enough. You can't speak the language. You can't do this, but I'm also not American. I'm certainly not white enough. So I can't fit in there. And so I think it's creating an environment and also dialogue with, from my end with our boys, like talking about skin color and like, hey, this is okay. And like, this is mommy and this is daddy. And also kind of, and this is the other side of my training that's so fascinating, is like having access to research and the psychological experiences of kids. And so one thing that I didn't realize, but bicultural and biracial kids are actually almost more prone to bullying because they are stuck in between two worlds. And you wouldn't necessarily think that. You would think somebody who is like fully something, fill in the blank, whatever it is. But I think what's so difficult about being in this place where you're stuck in between two worlds is that you don't feel like you belong to any one of them. So I think just being aware of that with our sons and realizing the struggles that may come up and being able to recognize, like, so they make him come home and like talk about an issue. And as a parent, hopefully we can like recognize, like, could this be one of those things connected with it? And how can we have a dialogue with them so they don't act that way and treat other kids that way, and also help them work through that, if that makes sense.
It's great to hear these discussions or having these conversations because I'm not dealing with those issues with my daughters. Mm-hmm. It's something that I've never felt the pain or the annoyance or the frustration of walking down the street and someone calling me a name. Like, as the hardest thing I can imagine, this is my white privilege speaking here, is like walking down the street in Manhattan with a Red Sox hat on. that is the extent of the discrimination or persecution that I've received as a white man from Connecticut. Like, that's it. And so for me, a lot of people that I grew up with probably aren't having those conversations because they simply aren't exposed, or their environment is very homogenous. And so it's good. I think it's great for our listeners to hear this, as someone who is married to, we have a white household, grew up in a white household, that I just don't have these conversations with my child. It never really occurs to me, those conversations, is understanding that, like, we have different experiences. Totally. One thing before we go, I wanted to address is, we talk about Duke's name. I'm just wondering, have you thought about Forrest for your second boy?
Forrest. Mm-hmm. Oh.
Yeah.
All right. No. No, Tom. Took me a minute.
Like, yeah, it took me a minute,
too. And it's not
going
to be Lehigh, either. It's not going to be Lehigh. It's not going to be Cameron.
What about Lee? It could be Lee. Lee.
It's not going to be Wake. It's not going to be Forrest. It's not going to be Demon. It's not going to be Deacon.
Well, I mean, we set the precedent here with Duke, so.
We did.
Just had to throw it out there.
Like, Forrest Gump? Where are you going with it? Yeah. I was like, that was the first thing that came to my mind. Like, that would set him up.
The best was the smile that Tom gave before he let it out. He was like, oh, I got one here.
Yeah, I was really excited about that one.
How long have you been waiting to drop that one? Were you waiting all show to drop that one?
It occurred to me, I was going to ask you if you had come up with a name for your second child. And I was thinking about, all right, how do they get to Duke? And I was like, ooh, Forrest. Forrest could work.
It took you about 75 minutes. That's the time. It's because we've known each other for a while. So you needed to warm up before you could drop some Wake Forest trash.
Well, so I do want Tom, I want to end on this quick 30-second, whatever. Give us advice for having two kids in the household, because I think your kids are just about the same, like two and a half years apart, something like that, right? Like,
yeah. So Madeline's 4 and Molly is 1.5. So yeah, 2.5 years.
Yeah, so we'll be just about the same. Give us the quick advice that we should know as baby 2 enters the universe with baby 1 as a toddler.
So, Prim, just be ready. Duke is going to be super attached to Ben. Because those first couple weeks, when you have baby number 2, you're going to be attached to baby boy number 2. And it's just, Duke needs to go outside. Well, I've got to go. I got to stay here with baby number 2. And so for the first like week or two, I was inseparable with Madeline. And I felt bad because I wanted to be close to my second child. But there was this understanding of like, I'm sorry, but I can't nurse my second daughter. Yeah. So I don't have the ability to be as useful to the second child as I am to the first one. So just a heads up, just be aware going into it that there is the potential. It might be different for you guys.
About it. No, that's not it. It's going to be, I'm going to cry. Yeah. That's going to be really hard.
But you also are going to love boy number 2. Like that was the thing. Allison was really worried about like not being there for Madeline as much.
Yeah.
But what she realized is she needed to love this baby and give all the love to bring this baby into the world with all the love and energy as possible. And I was there for Madeline. Right. And we were so lucky that I had paternity leave and I had the opportunity to be there for Madeline and just going outside. And that's the great thing right now. We're turning into spring. And it feels like, oh, finally we can go out and exercise and get outside and vaccinations are happening and it's great. Yeah. But just be aware with baby number 2 that it's going to have this, it's going to be over like in the first couple weeks.
Is it 2 weeks? That sounds real short, like 6 months.
I feel like it's not nearly as long as 6 months, but it's going to be, yeah, because once you kind of get into a sleeping schedule and you get into a rhythm, then Ben can kind of pitch in a lot more with Forrest. So, so that's number 1. Number 2 is, it's great when you see the 4-year-old being a big sister and teaching the 1.5-year-old things. And it is like the coolest thing. It is the coolest thing to watch them interact. And The best is when Madeline will take a book and say, Molly, would you like to read a book? And then Molly just gets up, plants herself in Madeline's lap and just sits there looking at her like, all right, let's go. And then they just sit there reading books together. And it is awesome. So they're not silos. Like, you're not going to have boy one, boy two, and they're going to be on these different tracks.
Yeah.
They're going to be on a lot of just like crisscrossing, and they're going to interact, and it's super special. So hold on to those moments because they're so great.
Okay.
Well, that was awesome feedback. Yeah. And I want to thank everybody for listening. I want to thank our special guest today, my amazing wife. She's an amazing mother, and you know,
the face that Prim just made, by the way.
She reacted like I called her a name for everyone there.
No, I just did something with my Skype. I can't see you guys. Sorry, I'm just being technical.
Had nothing to do with the love that he just shared for you. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's appropriate.
Thank you,
that's
baby.
Appropriate. I share my love, and she is working on something else. We have a reverse stereotype dynamic in this house. On that note, thank you, everybody. Tom, you did an amazing job leading us places that Prim probably wouldn't have necessarily shared as openly if I had just asked the questions. This was a great show, and I appreciate everything.
Thank you for having me on, you guys. Really appreciate you guys. You're doing such an awesome thing, having these discussions. And so, yeah, thanks for having me on and allow me to express my estrogen and progesterone.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you for opening up and talking about those things. And I know for all the dads and the parents out there listening that it certainly enriches them. And thank you for sharing.
Later, everybody.